Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
Thank you and welcome to Juno Afternoon from Community Supported KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us via our live stream on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Instagram and Facebook pages. Today, Wednesday, December 3rd, our gallery walk preview week continues with Juno artist Christine Carpenter, who has opened a new studio, and this Friday she is celebrating with a new show, From Palette to Pigment. She's here to share more about her show and a special workshop that she's teaching this month on how you can create your own pigments and paints from food. Next week, on Wednesday, December 10th, the Foundation for End-of-Life Care is hosting one of the leaders in palliative and hospice care, Dr. Ira Byock. We learn about the foundation and their work from Board President Bruce Wyrock. Plus, we hear from Dr. Byock about his work and what to expect at the talk next week. Those conversations coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Kushtak'u, Bill Fawcett. And the word this week is Tahwe.
Tahwe.
That means mountain sheep. And here's a sentence. I want a mountain sheep. Let's hear it again.
Tahwe.
Mountain sheep. Gunashchish Tchune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Kushtak O'ish Bill Fawcett was Slukach Adi and the child of a Southern Toshone man who passed away before Bill was born. His mother later married Tsihwa Bill Fawcett, who helped raise Bill. He lived on Akkwan Ani and enjoyed working with advanced language learners, helping them answer difficult questions about the language.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Local artist Christine Carpenter has opened a new studio in Juneau, Liaise Studios. Liaise meaning to establish a working relationship, typically in order to cooperate on a matter of mutual concern. I only know that definition because it's on her website. And this Friday, December 5th, during Gallery Walk, she is premiering a new show, From Palette to Pigment. Plus, she's got a special workshop where you can learn to make your own pigments and paints from food coming up later this month. The studio is in the Senate Mall at 175 South Franklin Street on what Christine likes to call floor 1.5. Christine, gunath cheesh for being here today. Wasiiti, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Boston?
I am excellent. Now, this studio that you have, it's open Thursday, Friday from 12 to 5, and Saturday from 11 to 5. So you're kind of like a weekend studio a little bit, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, right?
That's what I've been for the past year or so, but for this month, I'm going to open on Sundays, too, from 12 to 5.
Okay, for the holiday season.
Yeah.
As it were. And what brought you to opening a studio?
So my work has evolved into a lot of process-based craft, where I create my own pigments from things that I forage for or from my kitchen, as this new show will show you. And my work really requires more of a conversation with the viewer about how it was made and what it means, and the alchemy involved in the process, and I like to show people about how I make my work. And it just, you know, while my work stood by itself and people were interested in it, it really tended to lean itself more towards having one-on-one conversations with people. And so it became pretty clear to me about a year ago that I needed to open up my own space and allow people the behind-the-scenes tour of what goes on in order to make my work.
So often artists will have a studio in some basement somewhere, or, you know, some side door to some building that they rent you a room or whatnot. But this is a studio where the public can come and interact with you and have conversation.
Yeah. So there's two parts to the studio. There's the public-facing portion of the studio that has artwork for sale. It's set up more like a traditional studio where there's artwork on the wall. And also I sell things that you can buy to make your own works of art too.
Okay.
So paintbrushes and art supplies and paper, and there's some pigment supplies there too. And then the back half of the studio, which I call more the private studio, though if anybody asks, I will be happy to show them the mess that is back there. But the back half of the studio is where I make all of my pigments, and I work, and I and I paint, and it's storage too.
But you will unveil the curtain, as it were, if we.
If you ask, yes, I will be happy to show you the mess that is back there.
Okay.
Know that it is my working studio, so it is messy.
Well, it's supposed to be, right? Because you got to make art from chaos, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you tell me about how this work of basically turning things from your kitchen into artwork, which you're going to showcase in this new show that's opening on Friday. Tell me about that process. What is that process?
Well, I will be happy to show you. I'm doing a workshop this month, so if you're really interested, you should sign up, which you can find that on my website. But it is all really chemistry, as far as I know it to be. I'm not a chemist, but in order to make a pigment, you need to extract a color molecule from something.
Okay.
And so you add some different chemicals to a dye bath, essentially, and extract the color molecules from the dye bath.
And where did you learn to do that? Or how did you learn to do that, I guess?
A lot of internet research. I've taken several classes down south. I've signed up for, there's a pretty well-known natural pigment and dye group that's based out of the UK. And so I've joined a couple of working groups over there, and a lot of trial and error.
That's what I was going to say. Probably a lot of mistake and this worked, that didn't work. Hopefully you haven't lit anything on fire or nothing.
No, but one time I accidentally left the burner on overnight. That was a mistake.
Oops.
Nothing burned down, though.
That's good. That's lucky. And because you've been working in – would these count as watercolor?
Yeah.
In essence? So you're making watercolor pigments or paint out of the food.
Yeah. So pigment is a non-water-soluble powder, essentially, that you can then use to make all different kinds of paints or pastels. You mix pigment to whatever it's called binder, which is essentially a glue that then will adhere to your paper or to whatever medium it is that you're painting or drawing on. So
okay.
You can use pigment to make anything. If you're a oil artist, you can make your own oil paints from pigments as well. I just prefer to work in watercolor, and so my paints that you will see in my studio mostly are watercolor.
Okay. And so what are we going to be seeing in this show on Friday, from palette to pigment?
I have painted, I think, 9 paintings of different vegetables and food things. I guess there's also a fruit in there. Avocado makes a really beautiful mauve color, like a rosy color. You take the avocado pits and skins and you can make a mauve color. And beets make what you'd think that they would. Cabbage turns blue to purple, which is really beautiful.
Mm.
And then lemon black beans, you can make a really beautiful, like, the color that, like, black beans kind of, I mean, I think of everybody's kind of made maybe black bean soup before, and that, like, blue color that comes out, and black beans that, and then you can add color modifiers to your pigments that will shift the color that based off of the pH value to different colors. So you can get, like, up to 5 or 6 different colors from one pigment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And so you're going to teach us how to do this at a workshop that you're doing this month as well. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I have been asked this question many times to do a workshop to teach people about how they can make their own pigments. And historically, I've been using things that I foraged for, and so it's really hard to teach. I just have such a limited quantity of the things that I forage for that it's hard to really teach a workshop for it. But food feels like a really excellent way to teach people because it's really just food scraps. Everyone has avocado pits lying around, and I think we all in Juneau throw more avocados away and have a ton of pits left over than we actually eat avocados. So I wanted to teach what I've learned from a variety of different places down south, and teach people about the art of how to make your own pigments from things like in your kitchen, like avocados. I think we'll do avocados, cabbage, and red onion skins will turn green.
Okay. And you're doing 2 of these. One of them's already full, but you still have some spaces for Sunday, December 14th?
That's correct. Yeah. And it's an afternoon workshop. It's about 3 hours long. You'll get to take your own paint and pigments home. We'll go through the whole process together. And then at the end of it, you can take it home and you can paint with it.
That's really cool. You can go and find out more about that class at Christine's website, liaisestudio.com. That's spelled LIAISE, liaisestudio.com. You can also hit up the show, This Gallery Walk, Friday, December 5th. And her studio is in the Senate Mall on floor 1.5. Now, I am a fan of a movie called Being John Malkovich, which has the 7.5 floor. Is that where the inspiration for this came from? Or is it really a 1.5 floor? Or how did you come to this?
Well, I didn't come up with it. Travis at Alaska Litho called it that at one point. I was like, oh, yeah, that is kind of what it is. So it's at... If you have been in the Senate Mall, there's this stairs right ahead of you as you walk in, and you go up half of the flight of stairs, and you go straight ahead. And there's a couple little stairs over there, too. But it's in between the two floors. You wouldn't, like, continue on the stairway to go all the way up to Salon Cedar or to the Quilt Shop or to Wolf Song Wellness. You would just keep going straight. And so I feel like that's an easier way to describe it than on the second floor, which then people get confused about.
Because then it's like, that's not really the second floor.
Yeah.
Because the places upstairs call that the second floor?
Yeah.
I see. Well, I think Travis at AK Litho must be a fan of Being John Malkovich then.
Maybe. Yeah.
You've never seen
it? I've never seen it, no.
You have to watch it. Now that you have a studio, in essence, named after or named in spirit of, maybe. We'd have to confirm this with Travis.
I'll ask him.
Yeah, that would be pretty funny. But the show will be opening this Friday. You're going to show this new work, and then you'll have it up for the month at least.
Yeah.
But you also have other things available in your studio. And you can also see all of, I'm showing the poster for your show. You can see couple of the pigments that she uses. But you can also see more of Christine's work on her website, liaisestudio.com. And do you also have an Instagram?
I do. It's also Liaise Studio.
Liaise Studio. Yeah. How did you come up with Liaise Studio?
It was a collaboration with a friend of mine, but she mentioned that a lot of my work isn't really solo work. I think a lot of artists and designers think of themselves as working in isolation, and it's really important to me and it's really important to my craft to be in collaboration with other people. And so we found this word, and I mean, it's not like a new word I invented. It's just the verb of liaison, which I think most people are familiar with. And I think of my craft as being in collaboration with my community and with nature, as well as with my creative practice.
Well, it seems to fit really well because you have this idea and a part of creating the studio, which is to have conversation.
Right.
And as the definition that we start out with, typically in order to cooperate on a matter of mutual concern, and that is understanding pigments and paints made from food and other things, and sharing in that conversation of why that is and where you came to be when doing that.
Yep.
Have you always been working in that way in terms of making your own pigments and stuff?
No, this is a thing that came about maybe 2.5-3 years ago. I went onto a trip to Kodiak, and there was a woman who had a studio there that I toured her, just on a whim, toured her studio, and she was making everything from things that she found, and she had on the wall, my favorite color is orange, and on the wall was some yarn that she had dyed, and it was this really beautiful orange color. And I asked her how she made that, and she said, "Oh, I used lichen, like what we would call old man's beard, to dye this wool, and it turns this orange color." And it was just a jumping off point that I haven't gotten off this ride yet, so we'll see how long it lasts.
Well, as long as it lasts, we're happy to be the beneficiaries of it.
Thanks.
Thank you. Christine Carpenter, liaisstudio.com, as well as Gallery Walk opening down at the Senate Mall, 175 South Franklin Street, floor 1.5. Going to the teach for being here.
Thanks, Boston.
This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
Join the KTOO Newsroom on Thursday, December 4th at 8 a.m. for Coffee with KTOO. Meet our new managing editor, Lisa Fu, and share your thoughts and ideas with our reporters as we start the day with coffee, tea, and other treats. Stop by as we reflect on this past year's coverage and look ahead to 2026. That's Thursday, December 4th, starting at 8 a.m. in the KTOO studio.
This is Bird Notes. It's a warm morning in the tropical rainforest. You grab your binoculars and scan the thick canopy. But you're not spotting any birds. Just lots of green leaves and a tree stump. Hold up. That tree stump isn't a tree stump at all. It's a bird. Common pottus are champions of camouflage. In the daytime, these nocturnal creatures perch perfectly still on branches, heads pointed upward, bodies outstretched, and eyes closed down to tiny slits. With their cryptic coloration of brown, splashes of gray, and black spots, it's hard to tell where the branch ends and the bird's body begins. It's a wondrous adaptation to avoid predators. They're birds more often heard than seen, with a melodious but mournful song made at dawn, dusk, and by the light of the moon. The song earned pottus the name Poor Me One in Trinidad and Tobago. At dusk, common pottus awaken and take flight. They use their large yellow-orange eyes, long wings, and wide mouth to sally from a perch and gulp down flying insects. At the end of the night shift, pottus return to their branches to hide in plain sight for another day. For Bird Note, I'm Joanne Ryan.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. Special announcement. You can join us in the audience for a special holiday Juno Afternoon broadcast from the KTOO studio downstairs. It's going to be Friday, December 19th at 3 p.m. You can arrive at the studio by 2:45 so we can get all set up and go live at 3. Join us for music, performances, and more. Mark your calendars. No reservation required. Just bring your holiday cheer and join KTOO and Juno Afternoon in celebrating the arts and culture of the capital city. is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on the live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. And, of course, you can always subscribe to the podcast over at kto.org/JunoAfternoon. The Foundation for End-of-Life Care was first established in 1997. As the Foundation for Hospice and Home Care of Juno, it was created as a development foundation, and it helps to provide grant funding and support hospice and end-of-life care services. Bruce Wyrock is the president of the board. He grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, but he's been in Juno since 1976. Next Wednesday, December 10th, the foundation will present a special meet-and-greet with Dr. Ira Byock, who has been a leader in the field of palliative and hospice care for 5 decades. He will give a talk, What Mortality Can Teach Us About Living Fully. That's going to be December 10th, Wednesday. Doors open at 6 for a reception and a chance to meet Dr. Byock. The talk begins at 6:30, and as you'll hear from Dr. Byock later, he's also going to be talking with people afterwards. He likes to do a Q&A, and he says that's one of his favorite parts of the evening. It's going to be over at the Juno Arts and Culture Center, right across the street from KTOO at 350 Whittier Street. First, we're going to talk with Bruce, and then we will hear an interview I taped with Dr. Byock a couple of weeks back. Bruce, Gwyneth Cheese for being here. Wasiati, how are you?
Yeah, not mighty fine. Thanks.
Mighty fine. I like that. That's a good thing to do. I love your sweater. I'm getting in that holiday spirit. That's good.
Yeah.
So you've been here since 1976.
Yeah, I came over from, I was living in Sitka and Angoon, and I stopped off at Juno Cold Storage to drop some fish off from Angoon, and that was my first exposure to crystal.
So I love it. And what brought you to Alaska in the first place from Nebraska?
Well, coming from Nebraska, you can understand my fascination for trees, and I had been working on the railroad after high school for a couple of years and skydiving, and so I was going to be a smoke jumper.
Oh, wow.
And the only places that really offered a quick and dirty course in forestry were in Idaho or at Sheldon Jackson College in Sitka. So I went to school at Sheldon Jackson in 1974 when it was a school. And I landed and I lost interest in the woods and fell in love with the ocean and helped build the first private nonprofit salmon hatchery over there. And there we are today.
Wow, that's so amazing. And how did you get involved with the Foundation for End-of-Life Care? When did you get on the board for that?
I wasn't present at a meeting and got nominated, like most people on boards. No, Vance Sanders was on the board. The Foundation for End-of-Life Care was set up because Mrs. Kerrigan, whose husband started the phone company in Juno, had money, and at her end of life, she willed it to an entity to start hospice. And at that time, hospice was under the rubric of the Catholic Community Services, and it just recently moved to Bartlett Regional Hospital, and through the support by the assembly, Bartlett was urged to maintain and keep hospice, and we're very grateful for the assembly's direction on that. We're very grateful that Bartlett is running it. And so anyway, Van Sanders was the lawyer member on the board, and he decided to leave and nominated me. I was lawyering, and so I just came on not really knowing what the foundation was, and glad to be part of it. And it's been a very interesting thing for me. My interest really is there's very few things in life that are 100% guaranteed. What do we really know about life that's 100%? Well, we all know with 100% certainty that we're all going to die. We all know, for example, with 100% certainty, if a pregnant woman doesn't drink, her child will not have fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. We all know that if you get colonoscopies regularly, you will not get colon cancer. There's very few certainties in life. Mm. Taxes is one. And to me, end of life, the certainty of end of life meets the absolute uncertainty of what happens after end of life. Mm. And it's a very both factual and philosophic thing. And so I was on the board for a long time, and then I left. And last November, my mother died, and she died in hospice. And I had a very loving relationship with my mother. I was her power of attorney, and I had her power of attorney for healthcare. and I was the executor of her estate in her will. And I have six siblings in Nebraska. And I was very close to my mom. And one of the very important things when you're filling out, say, an advanced healthcare directive or power of attorney for healthcare is that you appoint someone who can express unconditional love for you. And to find somebody who knows and feels and adheres to the concept of unconditional love is very important and difficult. And unconditional love is a very important concept to understand as we approach end of life and as we care for people who are at end of life. And one of the important things about advanced healthcare directives that we discuss in our book, which is Feet of the Public, and we will be handing those out at Dr. Byock's event, is that we designate how we want to be treated at end of life and who it is that we designate as our agent to care for us and make decisions for us when we can't. And that kind of decision that the living make is very important for the medical profession. Because one of the main jokes that you hear is, why are there nails in a coffin? Which it's to keep an oncologist out. And what is very important is that you designate what kind of treatment you want. Do you want tubes? Do you want hydration and artificial nutrition? Do you want all kinds of intervention? Do you want CPR? Do you want to be restored at every possible crossroads? Or do you want a more peaceful end of life? Do you want to be alleviated with pain? Mm-hmm. Do you want to die at home? Do you not want those interventions because it just really can make life miserable, even though life may be short? And I think talking about that with your agent, Mom and I did that, and I was very clear about what she wanted. Mm. And in my circumstance, it was very difficult because some people swooped in and said, she doesn't want that. She wouldn't want that. I don't want that. And it's not about what somebody else wants. It's not about what a sibling wants or an uncle or an aunt or anything. It's what the person who's at end of life wants. Mm-hmm. And adhering to that, even to the detriment of a relationship. And that takes a lot of courage, and it's very difficult in some situations. And so educating the public about this is really the main thing for our foundation. And I should mention Dr. Byock is coming up here because we work closely with hospice and the hospice director, medical director is Taylor Dunn, Dr. Dunn. And Dr. Bob Urata is on our board of directors. He was hospice director for 40 years in Juneau. And they really recommended Dr. Byock. So Dr. Byock is going to be speaking with all the medical staff and nurses, hospice volunteers, everyone at the hospital cafeteria on Tuesday night to give physicians who attend continuing medical education, which they all need. And our mission is to provide education, not just to the public, but to physicians who want it. And that's what the physicians indicated they wanted so they could get this continuing medical education. And we're providing it free of charge. And we're happy to do that. And I should also mention that our board of directors is Roman Montica, who's a hospice volunteer, and Dr. Urata, Gordon Blue, who's a pastor at Holy Trinity Church, Carrie Pusich, whose mother, Sue Douglas, started our foundation, Kristen Jones, who's a counselor at NAMI, Sean O'Sullivan, who works as a grant administrator at Search, Sue Nielsen, who works with AARP, Janet Hampton, who's an accountant at Search, Jeff Short, who's a former school board member, who's a great fishery scientist, and Angela Davis, who's the CFO at Bartlett. And I think it's also interesting, as far as education is concerned, and our foundation and the people of Juneau, of why this is relevant to everyone, is recently the Juneau Economic Development Council came out with its annual report about Juneau. And it confirmed what our foundation has already done through Dr. Short, Jeff Short. And we are an aging population here. Mm-hmm. And we are continuing to age, and the people who are living in Juneau are staying here in Juneau. So the portion of our population that's aging and that is older is a lot higher now than it used to be. And as the baby boom ages, we're all going to need end-of-life services. And Bartlett Regional Hospital is the only accredited hospice provider in all of Southeast Alaska. Search provides valuable medical services for communities and people throughout Southeast Alaska. But Bartlett is the only accredited service for hospice and end-of-life care. And it's very important to use that service as we have it. One of the things that's interesting in terms of educating the public about hospice and how we support hospice is the number one mistake that people make is not getting into hospice early enough. People will go to hospice, say, the day before they die or a couple of days before. But if you look historically at how hospice can be used for end-of-life care, look at Jimmy Carter. He was in hospice for a year. People historically and statistically who go into hospice earlier live longer, higher quality, better lives than those who go in late. And it's something that the public sometimes is afraid of because, oh, if I go into hospice, that means I'm dying. Well, we're all dying. How do we want to be treated at the end of life? What care do we want? And do we want that love and care and attention? And it's massaging, it's counseling, it's spiritual counseling, it's administering morphine if you need it to alleviate pain and those kinds of things. And it's a very, very, actually, for me, self-actualizing thing to help educate the public about all of this.
Well, you're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm talking with Bruce Rywalk from the Foundation for End-of-Life Care Board President. You can find out more about the foundation if you haven't heard about it or if you need to figure this out. And like Bruce says, we're an aging population, and they have some resources and other things available to you. You can go to foundationforendoflifecare.org, and you can find out more about the information. Now, before we play this interview with Dr. Bayok, Bruce, can you tell us a little bit about, you told us a little bit about how you got him, but he is a leader in palliative, and he's going to explain what the difference between palliative and hospice here in just a second in the interview. But how did you go about reaching out to him, and tell us a little bit more about him before we go into this interview?
Well, the first suggestion of Dr. Bayok came from Dr. Bob Urata, the hospice director in Juneau, former hospice director. And he wanted Bayok to come up here, and Hal Geiger, a former member of the board, Dr. Hal Geiger, who helped write our book, which is free, suggested Bayok many years ago, and it just didn't happen. Then I talked to Taylor Dunn, and I read Dr. Bayok's book, and I talked to Dr. Dunn about it, and I was going to poll the medical staff about what they would, who they would like to hear about these topics of end-of-life care. And Dr. Dunn said, forget it. We don't need to poll anybody. We want to bring Bayok up here. So Bob Urata spent his own money to go back to Harvard to listen to Bayok speak. Other people who have been involved in hospice and as volunteers have traveled to hear him speak. And he's traveled widely around the country to speak about hospice, home care, and palliative care. And so I wrote him through his wife, Yvonne Corbiel, and they live in Montana. And then I called her, and we talked, and his schedule was available. And unfortunately, it's a dark, cold time of year, and he's not up here to fish. But he's up here to educate physicians and the public. And,
yeah.
And he's eager to come. He hasn't been here before. And so thanks to Dr. Taylor and Dr. Taylor Dunn and Dr. Bob Urata. That's why we have Dr. Bayok here.
Excellent. Well, he is going to be speaking next Wednesday night, December 10th at 6 p.m. The door is open for a reception and to meet the author. He's going to be giving a talk, What Morality Can Teach Us About Living Fully. He's going to explain what that talk will entail in the interview that we're going to play here. This is going to be happening at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center just across the street here from KTOO, again, next Wednesday. And you can learn more about Dr. Bayok by going to his website, Ira Bayok, B-Y-O-C-K, Ira Bayok.org, and you can also find out more about the foundation at foundationforendoflifecare.org. That's a local Juneau organization working with hospice and palliative care and helping to get the word out about it. And obviously, you can pick up one of these books next week at the talk.
And Hearthside is selling Dr. Bayok's books on hospice and home care of Juneau. We'll have a table at the Jack event, and we will be handing these out to anybody who comes for free.
Excellent. Yeah, and he's written four books. He's going to talk a little bit in this interview about one of the ones that I really love, which is The Four Things That Matter Most. So let's take a listen. I had a chance to talk with Dr. Bayok a couple of weeks ago, and here's that interview with Dr. Bayok here on Juno Afternoon. Thanks for coming in, Bruce. Really appreciate it.
Anytime.
Gunath Chish, Igudi, thank you so much for joining us. Wasa Iti, how are you today, Ira?
I'm very well. It's really a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for doing this.
Let's start first with like setting the groundwork here. What is a palliative care physician?
So palliative care is a subspecialty in American medicine. It became a formal subspecialty in 2006. It is a specialty that focuses on people with serious, often life-limiting or potentially life-threatening conditions, and focuses on their physical well-being, treating things like pain and nausea and, you know, bowel and everything, skin problems, urinary, blah, 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 all of that, sources of discomfort and frank suffering, but also their well-being, their emotional, social, and even spiritual well-being, as well as supporting them and their family through the course of serious illnesses.
Okay, now a lot of people have heard of hospice care. I know I went through that with my mom. Is there a difference between palliative care and hospice care?
So it's one specialty. The specialty is hospice and palliative medicine. As a discipline, as kind of a service delivery model, if you will, or programs, palliative care grew out of hospice. But hospice was certainly the nidus of it in the Western world. It started in the United Kingdom in the 1960s. They developed hospice programs for seriously ill and dying Britons. It was exported to Canada and the United States. And this model flourished because, as good as American medicine is at treating disease, we're not so good at treating the personal experiences of illness and caregiving and dying and grieving. I was involved since mid-1978, to tell you the truth, during my medical training, got involved in fledgling hospice program in the Central Valley of California, but stayed involved in helping to develop hospice as a service delivery model, if you will, hospice programs in the United States. And out of that, as I mentioned, sort of grew this discipline of palliative care. It takes this team-based approach that we think of when we think of hospice, of a physician, nurses, social workers, chaplains, and expands it beyond the boundaries of hospice under, for instance, Medicare, which Medicare requires that to get the benefits of a hospice program, frankly, you have to acknowledge that you're dying, something which, frankly, many of my patients are reluctant to do, right? It's bad enough to be seriously ill. I'm not quite there yet, right? And doesn't require, under Medicare, for instance, in a trade-off for getting this quite remarkable and generous package of benefits for your comfort and quality of life, people basically need to forego further disease treatments, cancer or your heart failure or your liver disease. And at some point that trade-off becomes well worth it, because at some point it's very common that disease-focused treatments, surgery, transplants, whatever, cancer chemotherapy, is an approach with diminishing returns. And that people feel better and frankly even live longer when they stop trying to fight their disease and just try to live as well as possible for as long as they can live in a way that is worthwhile to them and their family.
You got involved in this in your training as in the medical profession. What drew you specifically to this particular field?
Well, I started because I saw people suffering needlessly. Suffering of pain that we could treat if we spent the time to figure out the details of what was causing their particular pain, not assuming, well, it's cancer pain or, you know, it's something else. And just the details of what they needed to physically, so that they weren't in pain or, you know, constipated, frankly, or itching, or that we could treat that. What kept me involved, what really sucked me in as a professional and changed my career, was that every once in a while, in sitting with and caring for somebody who was incurably ill and knew it, by treating their pain and the bowels and all the rest, I would find that there was a sense of well-being. I was surprised in a sense and did not anticipate, but I couldn't deny. Right. I often tell a story about a guy I remember clearly. I call him Mr. Rodriguez because I can't remember actually what his name was, but I came to see him one morning on rounds. He had a liver full of colon cancer and was dying, and he knew he was dying because I'd talked to him myself a day or two before. But he was comfortable, and I crouched down to be at eye level, and I said, Mr. Rodriguez, how are you doing this morning? And he looked me right in the face, Boston, and he said, I'm well, doctor. How are you? I'm well, doctor. It became clear that it wasn't the morphine or, you know, he wasn't euphoric. It was, he was choosing his words correctly, but he felt well within himself. He was sad, but not suffering in that regard. That changed my career. That a few interactions like that made me realize that there was something about the human condition that didn't foreclose us being well, you know, right within ourselves, right with others, right with the world, right with our maker, even in the last weeks, days, hours of life.
I know you've had a wide range of careers inside this field because you've led care programs. You've been a professor at Dartmouth. You've written three or four books on this subject, and I know that your research has been invaluable in leading the way in this field. And I'm just curious, like from the 70s to now, like what are some of the major changes you've seen develop over those five decades?
Things are dramatically different. I mean, now there are 6,000 or more hospice programs across the United States. Palliative care exists in every large hospital and health system. There's a lot where it doesn't exist and should, but it's become commonplace. At its best, hospice and palliative care are frankly miraculous in their ability to care for people and not only alleviate suffering, but preserve and foster well-being for people. That's the good news. It's dramatic. I mean, I often say that hospice and palliative care are probably the most important advance in American healthcare in the 20th century that few people know about. You know, because we don't involve PET scanners or MRIs or genomics, but as a service delivery innovation, it's absolutely brilliant and reliable. It works. The bad news is that American medicine is dysfunctional, to say the least. And there's a lot of frank greed and profit-taking in American medicine that have hollowed out a lot of the best innovations and the most powerful, remarkable science in the process of getting it to people. We constrain them because of excessive costs and charges and profit-taking by the corporate owners and on, insurance dysfunction. I could keep going. And that's the challenge. Where I still have most hope, and I think our field, my field, has succeeded, even though it's kind of turned but away in recent years from this, is to foster kind of cultural change in how we, in general, approach illness and caregiving and dying and grieving. Many more of us realize that these are not just medical problems. They involve medical problems, of course, but they are far more broadly and profoundly parts of human life, parts of our personal lives, our families' lives, and our communities' lives.
That's a great segue because I'd love for you to talk a little bit. You have a book called The Four Things That Matter Most, and it was recently used as the basis for a touching moment in the TV show The Pitt. Will you share your experience with that show and how that moment came about?
So The Four Things is a book. The Four Things That Matter Most is a book, but the four things are really four statements that I have found for years in caring for seriously ill and dying people have real practical wisdom. So they are, please forgive me, I forgive you, thank you, and I love you. Pretty simple. And it stems from the fact that if you ask somebody being wheeled into transplant surgery or facing cancer chemotherapy for the third or fourth time, you know, what really matters to you most now? I promise the answer will always entail the names of people they love. It doesn't matter what language you're having this conversation in, what the color of their skin is, what their religion is, where you are geographically, their socioeconomics. This one is a constant that runs through the human condition. And the fact is that human beings tend to, we tend to be imperfect. And our relationships are often imperfect. And that's just normal, and it's fine. But when somebody is seriously ill, it's important that they have at least considered the opportunity of saying things that would be left unsaid between them and people they love, or frankly once loved, a previous spouse or a brother you haven't, you know, have separated from and haven't had a good conversation with in years. When one or the other of you is facing, you know, mortality, there's often value in saying, please forgive me. I forgive you, because who among us have had perfect relationships? Thank you, and I love you. So I've been teaching this for years, Boston. As it was, I was practicing emergency medicine in Missoula, Montana, where I now again live. I got a call from an ambulance coming to us about a guy with severe back pain, belly pain, and a low blood pressure, which is, to an ER doc, one of the things that comes up is he's got an abdominal aortic aneurysm that's leaking. And I actually called the OR, told him to get ready. We got a guy coming in. I'm going to make his ER visit as short as I can, stabilize him and get him upstairs if you can take him to surgery as soon as possible. And he got to the ER and I talked to him and immediately he said, yeah, I know. My internist and I know this thing's been there, and we've decided because of everything else going on in my health and all that, that I wouldn't likely survive an operation and I'm not going to have it fixed. And so, you know, I know. And so I called down called the OR off, sat down, got him meds that make him comfortable and gave him a bunch of fluids. And I won't go into the technicalities of treating somebody in this circumstance, but I stabilized his blood pressure temporarily and made him comfortable. And then we talked about the fact that he was likely in the last hours of life. And his family came in, his wife and daughters came in, adult daughters, and I gently explained to them what's going on with his medical condition. And then I wondered aloud in their presence if it wouldn't have value for them, once we got him to a private room and comfortable upstairs, if they wouldn't consider saying the four things to one another. And I went through it. Please forgive me. I forgive you. Thank you. I love you. And just said, you know, if you're forced to say goodbye, these are four things to consider saying before goodbye. And I don't know if it'll be a value to you, but it's been a value to a number of patients and families I've cared for over the years. Okay, that was it. Got him upstairs. 6 hours or more later, before I left the emergency department, one of the daughters stopped back by the emergency department and very emotionally said, Dad died, he died peacefully. And Dr. Bayak, I can't thank you enough for offering that suggestion to us, because we did spend a fair amount of time using those four things as a way of just visiting during these last hours. And I think it was such a profound experience for us. So to answer your question finally, I was asked by the writer's room of the Pit to kind of consult with them as they were working on this new show, had to do with emergency medicine. They were pretty tight-lipped about what it was. I didn't know who the star was. I pitched them this idea. I said, you know, this is a real case. I don't know, but, you know, it's worth running it by you guys. And it turns out Noah Wiley, who's the star and the chief writer, was in the room and, you know, loved the idea and later wrote that into chapter four of The Pit.
So you're coming to Juneau to give a talk for the Foundation for the End of Life Care, which is an organization here in Juneau. It's on December 10th. It's titled, What Mortality Can Teach Us About Living Fully. I feel like we've covered a lot of what might be in this talk, but I want to give you the opportunity to have you share with us a little about what folks can expect from that talk. I know they also will get a chance to talk with you beforehand at 6 o'clock. There's going to be a meet and greet, and then at 6:30, you're going to give this talk. What will the talk
covering? And there'll be a Q&A afterwards. I hope to talk.
Oh, okay. More Q&A. Yeah.
You know, 45 minutes or so, and then open it up, which is frankly for me the most fun to dialogue with people.
Yeah, for sure.
So I'm delighted to be coming to Juno for one thing. Juno has a good rep, you know? I mean, before I was an emergency doc, I was a rural family doc. I like towns the size of Juno and feel very at home there. So the talk will be lively, I promise. I'm going to gently challenge people to think about what it means to live fully as a mortal human being. I'm on this quest to sort of culturally recenter illness and caregiving and dying and grieving as parts of healthy, normal human life. And I say that without trying to put rose-colored glasses on. I mean, all of these things are as hard and as unwanted as one can imagine. And they're part of human life. They're part of family life. They're part of community life. You know, you can look it up. It's just there, right? It just happens. Well, I just want to talk about what we can do to rest the human potential to live fully and to actually do what we need to be, as what I talked about with my realization with Mr. Rodriguez, to how can we be right with each other, right with ourselves, right with God, nature, however you define the larger context, leaving nothing left undone or unsaid as we, you know, shuffle off this mortal coil.
So last question for you before I let you go, Dr. Bayok. What are you looking forward to next in the field? And I mean, like, does new technology or future developments in science, does it bring new things to palliative care in some way? And how do you want to complete your work over the next, you know, 20, 30 years?
Thank you. I'm gonna step aside for that. There is new technology and new methodologies and therapeutic resources coming on board. I mean, a big one is the use of psychedelic-assisted therapies, which I saw back in the 1970s happen at the National Institutes of Mental Health. But then, you know, LSD and psilocybin became illegal drugs in the mid-1970s or late 1970s, and doctors stopped using them for 35 years. Now research is coming back, and there's a number of research studies that show that when used carefully, and I have to say that all caps bold, when used carefully under supervised circumstances with adequate screening of the right patients, preparation, guidance, accompanying people during psychedelic experiences, and integration of counseling thereafter, these can be remarkably powerful tools to help people who are facing mortality, maybe dealing with the existential issues of non-being, you know, I mean, to reframe their experience in a way that allows them to live more fully and more comfortably. It's a powerful, in many people, a way of dealing with anxiety, depression, a sense of hopelessness. So that's a very exciting development that that needs the field of palliative medicine to do more research and develop delivery models so that it can be safe and effective. Because as we also know, these drugs, LSD, psilocybin, when used indiscriminately, can be very dangerous. They are dangerous to people. But not, frankly, they're very safe when used in a very rigorous therapeutic modality. The other thing I'm trying to do is, frankly, protect hospice particularly, but also the other delivery models of palliative care from the, you know, shareholder-owned, profit equity-owned corporations that are trying to take this very tender human relationship and interaction that is so therapeutic and commodify it in ways that are depersonalized and transactional. And that, I mean, that just hurts my heart. I think there are ways to protect that against that, but it needs a lot of effort.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bayak. I really appreciate it. Gunath Cheesh, for joining us.
I'm really looking forward to being with you all in person. Thanks for doing this.
That's Dr. Ira Bayak here on Juno Afternoon on KTO. He'll be speaking for the Foundation for End-of-Life Care next week, What Mortality Can Teach Us About Living Fully. It's Wednesday, December 10th at 6 p.m. The doors will open. 6:30, the talk begins. And as Ira said, he'll be sticking around after for some Q&A. That is going to be at the Juno Arts and Culture Center at 350 Whittier Street next Wednesday, December 10th. You can find out more about Ira at his website, irabyock.org. Or you can find out more about the Foundation for End-of-Life Care at foundationforendoflifecare.org. Two other things to mark on your calendar. Tomorrow, you can join the KTO newsroom at 8 a.m. for Coffee with KTOO. Meet the new managing editor, Lisa Fu, and share your thoughts and ideas with our reporters. As we start the day with coffee, tea, and other treats, you can stop by and reflect on this past year's coverage, and they will also be looking ahead to 2026. That's tomorrow at 8 a.m. And then mark your calendar for a special holiday Juno afternoon broadcast from the KTOO studio downstairs on Friday, December 19th at 3 p.m. You can arrive at the studio by 2:45 so we can get ready to go live right at 3. Join us for music, performers, and more. No reservations required. Just bring your holiday cheer and join KTOO and Juno Afternoon in celebrating the arts and culture of the capital city. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Wrap it up for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, UAS previews their Winter Fire Showcase. We'll also have more gallery walk previews with the Lodestone Library. And the CBJ will share how you can provide feedback on the Marine Passenger Fees Project Fund. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives on KTO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you, never more important than now. And Alaska Airlines, Club 49, Hanson Grass, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Cheesh, have a lovely Wednesday, Juno evening.